Here is what we are going to do today. We are going to explain international trade with a barbecued pork chop on a stick. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 29th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. That pork chop coming up in just a bit, but a couple of data points as we get going today, teeing up the economic policy news this Wednesday. First of all, an update on gross domestic product growth thereof. Actually, it was revised up today 4.2% for the April to June quarter, so that is good. Also, and insert the standard caveat here, please, the stock market is not the economy, etc., 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 but both the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 hit new record highs today, so there is that. Now, though, to the policy. There's a Friday deadline for Canadians to sign on to the deal that Mexico and the United States announced earlier this week to replace, in some yet-to-be-determined form, NAFTA. Car makers are watching more closely than most. The Trump administration wants to reverse an industry trend of building more cars in Mexico. Talks are still fluid, as they say. But there are some questions as to whether the plan currently on the table would change much on the ground for the companies that make the cars. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong gets us going.
U.S. automaking in Mexico goes back to 1925, but lately it's really picked up. Economist Susan Helper studies factory supply chains at Case Western Reserve University.
Most of the new plants built, say, in the last 10 years in North America have been in Mexico.
One reason is cheaper labor. But the U.S.-Mexico trade deal, which is still in flux and may add Canada, aims to create more jobs in the U.S., the White House says. It would require vehicles to have 40 to 45% of their content made by workers earning $16 an hour or more. Kristen Gichek is with the Center for Automotive Research in Michigan. She says most vehicles meet that threshold already, so nothing would change. For vehicles that don't,
many of them are small sedans that don't have a lot of pricing power. And the U.S. market is kind of fickle on sedans anyway. So companies that produce those models, they could just remove those vehicles from the U.S. market.
Or they'd pay a small tariff. She says neither scenario would bring many jobs back to the States. A second provision would increase the percent of North American content in vehicles from 62.5% today up to 75%. Gichek says for automakers,
many of them are already there. Something like 99% of all vehicles currently made in North America meet the 62.5. And there are a few vehicles that are kind of on the bubble, on the 75%, that it wouldn't take much to move them up.
Which, again, to her, means no big change in where cars would be made. If automakers fail these auto DNA origin rules, the penalty on the books is a 2.5% tariff. And that is an automotive slap on the wrist, says business professor Frank Dubois at American University.
That isn't, in my mind, a large enough penalty to make any dramatic overhauls to their supply chains.
He says there is a wild card that could really shake up the talks. The Trump administration wants to add a stiff tariff of 25% on some vehicles from Mexico. Now, this is still up in the air. It could apply to Mexican imports above a certain quota, or it could apply to future cars made in Mexico that flunk the rule of origin tests.
This would really have a chilling effect on any sort of new foreign direct investment initiatives in Mexico and Canada.
That measure, if it's included, could bring more plants back to the U.S. But analysts warn beware unintended consequences. If more vehicles are made with expensive U.S. labor, prices could go up. Or if more imports pay the 25% tariffs, prices could go up. And that could be the trade-off for any reshoring of American auto jobs. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
I was in Minnesota the past couple of days, as I think I mentioned, and you pretty much couldn't turn around without somebody there talking about the state fair. Something like 2 million people visit the fair during its 12-day run, going on now through Labor Day, by the way, should you be in the Twin Cities. There's live music, lots of fried food and sweets, rides, animals as well, cows, pigs, lambs, the whole deal. Also, politicians talking about the issues of the day with voters, issues like the trade war. Minnesota Public Radio's Elizabeth Dunbar talked to fairgoers about the fair and about free trade.
On the first day of the state fair, dozens of people are braving a long line and clouds of barbecue smoke for an $8 pork chop on a stick.
So the pork chops were worth the wait?
Oh my gosh, they were fantastic.
A short stroll away from the pork chop stand, the live version. In the swine barn, you can pet a piglet, pick up some state fair fashion, pink paper headband with pig ears, and maybe even ask a real farmer or two how they're doing.
Being a hog farmer right now is hard. It's really hard.
That's Wanda Patchy, who's volunteering at the swine barn. She raises more than 4,000 pigs a year in a town called Welcome, Minnesota. Retaliatory tariffs Mexico and China have placed on U.S. pork products are hurting farmers like her who depend heavily on export markets. She's getting less than $100 a pig today. That covers the cost of the piglet and the grain needed to help it reach market size, but little else.
We're probably losing at least $30 to $40 a head, so we got to get the tariff situation figured out for our country.
A $12 billion ag bailout the Trump administration announced this week might provide some relief, but most farmers I talked with would much rather get a good price for their crops than get a federal handout. For now, Patchy is cheerfully encouraging state fairgoers to buy pork, even as she feels battered by the trade war.
We're really very proud of what we do. We love growing food for people, and I'm just like, open those markets up for us. Let us do what we do best.
You'll get a different take on tariffs from many people who make their livings from mining, like Bob Ryan. He's working at the United Steelworkers booth, handing out insulated sleeves for soda and beer cans. Ryan says he does understand why many food growers are opposed to recent U.S. trade policy.
I feel terrible for the farmers that are impacted because of decisions that are made far above anybody's pay grade that I know.
But he supports U.S. tariffs, specifically the ones on steel and aluminum imports. It was just 4 years ago when nearly 2,000 workers in Minnesota's iron ore mines and taconite processing plants were laid off. Entire communities suffered, and the region blamed China for dumping steel into the U.S. market. Ryan credits tariffs for helping turn things around.
We are running at 100% capacity at all of our mines.
Minnesota's not just mines and farms, of course. The state is the headquarters of giant companies like Target and United Healthcare. Bob Cooterly works just a few miles away from the fairgrounds at the University of Minnesota. He's a professor of international trade and investment policy. He says in the big picture, Minnesota is not the kind of place that's going to benefit from current trade policy.
Unlike some states, Pennsylvania, Ohio, that have been terribly battered by the changing global economy.
Minnesota, he says, is likely a net loser in the trade war. In St. Paul, I'm Elizabeth Dunbar for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, trade war, schmade war. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Usually when we talk to people for a corner office interview, it's the person actually running a company that can or maybe has changed our lives. Today, something a little bit different. One of the people who can shape those companies from the very beginning. Venture capital and venture capitalists can turn a person with a great idea into a person running a company. Ann Muraco is the co-founding partner at a VC firm up in Silicon Valley. It's called Floodgate. She was an early investor in companies like Lyft and TaskRabbit, Refinery29 as well, just to name a couple of them. And welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So venture capitalists are, somehow they seem like these exalted beings, right? That they know where things are going to come from and they get to dispense the money. Why does venture capital matter, I guess, is the basic question.
I think venture capital matters because at least at the very stage that I invest in, which I would say is early, way too early, and sometimes ambiguously legal early,
wow.
We are looking at companies and technology well before everyone else recognizes what it is and where it's going.
So give me an example. I read in some of my background reading for this interview an article in which you went and you waited outside some guy's classroom at Stanford with $1 million check in your hand.
Yes. So I found a company called Ayosti, and it was founded actually by the former chairperson of the math department at Stanford. Mm. They sent me 4 math papers, no business plan. And so I put it at the top of the pile, started reading them, and realized that there was not just a raw technology here, but when math is done right, it's something actually quite beautiful. And I saw the opportunity to really figure out what is hidden within data. And I think that the thing for me was I felt like, you know, there are not that many PhDs who are also venture capitalists and who will sit down and read a math paper. And so I felt like if I couldn't invest in this company, then there was a major problem. And so I ran to one of his classrooms and I said, Gurjeet, please take this money.
So, I should know this, but I don't. How'd it work out for you?
So initially, he actually said no. He said, I don't even know what I would do with $1 million. And so we spent some time actually working through what that $1 million would get him. Huh. And once he had a potential customer locked up and he said, I think I'm ready for money now.
Wow.
That's when we decided to jump in and lead around in IOSTI.
Take a step back for me, would you, from what you all do, those very, very early stages. And since I'm sure you look at this, talk to me about venture capital in the American startup economy right now. I mean, there's a lot of money out there. Is there more money than ideas, or are there more ideas than money, I guess, is what I want to know.
I believe that capital actually has become quite abundant in this space. And so from a venture capitalist perspective, the competition is actually fairly intense. That said, not every single idea is being chased.
Yeah.
So you'll find actually great entrepreneurs out there who haven't been found or who don't fit the exact profile that everyone believes is the great startup founder. My job is to find those founders so that we can then build a business that has the potential for bringing prosperity to all.
Well, look, since you alluded to it, since you are one of those on the list of, you know, 50 brilliant VC women in Silicon Valley or whatever, I mean, you're on all those lists. I do want to ask you about the role of venture capital in diversity in Silicon Valley and technology in this economy. I mean, you've expressed frustration with it, a lot of frustration.
Yes. I mean, I think that by having a more diverse group of investors who then deploy the capital out to entrepreneurs, we will also be able to recognize the most diverse group of entrepreneurs. And I believe that the entire U.S. economy benefits, the global economy benefits when we are able to find the best talent, the best ideas, wherever they may exist.
Anne Mura Koh, co-founding partner at Floodgate up in Silicon Valley. Anne, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We've got more of my conversation with Anne Mura Koh, including how much progress she thinks the venture capital industry has made on that diversity problem. It's on our Corner Office podcast. We've been doing a series for a couple of 3 years now about how people are feeling about their economic lives away from the headlines. My economy, we call it. There were some headlines this week about Puerto Rico and the death toll from Hurricane Maria being nearly 3,000 people, far, far higher than earlier official estimates. So for today's installment of My Economy, one of many Hurricane Maria recovery stories, a chef in San Juan who returned to her restaurant not long after the storm.
My name is Maria Mercedes Grubb, and I am the executive chef of the restaurant Gallo Negro in San Juan, Puerto Rico. The first time I walked into the restaurant after the hurricane, it was pretty hellish. Everything was covered in mold, just a thick layer of mold on the tables and on the bar. And we took everything apart. Every single bottle of spice had to be wiped down and had a tiny generator so that we could turn on some fans and some lights. We have no windows. So we're just sweating it out and just cleaning everything. We went without power for 3 months and without water for 2 months. When we reopened, I was literally by myself in the kitchen. It was just my brother and I and the dishwasher. We had to shorten the menu. We had to shorten the prices. Everything had to be purchased at the local Costco. But the beautiful thing that I remember was just every guest that came through, you just hug them and just be so happy to see them. And everybody told you their story about what they just went through. And that sense of community was just like the thing that kept you smiling, the thing that kept you wanting to just push and keep reopening every day. Right now in Puerto Rico, you wish that your day, instead of 12 hours, had at least an extra 2 hours just to cope with traffic. There's still a lot of like power lights out. You have to work harder now to be able to do what used to be day-to-day business. But we're turning that into a positive thing, you know, just making ends meet and just treating it like a Iron Chef basket sort of situation. You just open the basket and deal with what you have in hand. We're still going, opening every single day, keeping our doors open. We just want people to know that we're here and we're open for business.
This series only happens if you help us tell your stories of your economy. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up.
You know, and it's marvelously mad, but very freeing.
It used to be penance. Now it's just fun. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. Dow Industrial's up 60 points today, 0.2%, 26,124. The NASDAQ, 79 points to the good, 0.9%, 8,109. The S&P 500, 16 points higher, 0.5%, 29,014. As we noted, the auto industry is following trade developments out of Washington, D.C. oh so carefully. So we merge into the slow lane to check on Ford Motor Company. That decelerated nearly 0.4%. GM downshifted more than 0.5%. Fiat Chrysler off 0.1%. In sports retail, Dick's Sporting Goods says its quarterly sales ran off track in part because the power brand Under Armour is selling its athleisure wear through department stores. Dick's stumbled more than 2%. Under Armour fell behind early in the day but closed up 0.6%. You're listening to Marketplace. We heard from John in Austin, Texas, not too long ago, who says he and his wife think Marketplace is the most informative and creative radio program in America, which is nice to hear. If you agree with John, please join him as a Marketplace investor by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to John and everybody who makes our work possible. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's a gubernatorial debate today in New York. Governor Andrew Cuomo and Cynthia Nixon, his challenger in that state's Democratic primary. Policy will undoubtedly come up, but the early buzz about this thing is all about the temperature. Cuomo reportedly prefers things on the cooler side when he appears in public. Nixon's campaign has asked that the thermostat be set to a balmy 76 degrees and pointed out that workplaces are, and this is a quote, notoriously sexist when it comes to room temperature. We asked Marketplace's Mariel Segarra to get to the bottom of this summertime battle of the sexes.
It's the sound that starts the battle every summer. The AC kicks on and makes a lot of people unhappy. Amy Goodman works in TV programming in Atlanta, and she says her office is freezing.
It's so, so cold.
She keeps a plug-in hand warmer at her desk and a hoodie in her cube.
There's six of us that sit in a communal space, and all six of us have heaters under our desks.
All six are women. They haven't bothered trying to ask the building manager for help.
I've only been at this job for a year, but in places before, it didn't matter who you talk to. It's not going to change.
The thing is, men and women tend to prefer different temperatures.
The root of this is men, in general, have much faster metabolisms than women by about 30%.
That's Nate Adams. He consults homeowners on how to manage their energy use. He says men's faster metabolisms make them run hotter. Also,
men typically wear more clothing than women.
You see the divide over temperatures in a lot of offices. HR consultant David Lewis has 90 employees. More than 80 of them are women. And he hears a lot of complaints about the AC. But he says there's not a whole lot he can do.
The building provides the air conditioning, and balancing the temperature in the office is just a nightmare, according to the building maintenance people.
Of course, according to the Department of Labor, 60% of building maintenance people are men. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
To Today in There Really Is a Business Opportunity in Everything, we submit to you the pilgrimage. There's the Hajj, of course. Muslims going to Mecca. People are seeking out shrines in Europe in ever-increasing numbers. And now there's a drive underway in Britain to revive the practice there. A group called the British Pilgrimage Trust is drumming up interest. Marketplace's Stephen Beard went on a one-day pilgrimage and filed this report from St. Nicholas Church in the tiny English village of Icklesham.
Hi, everyone.
You could tell this was going to be no ordinary guided tour when the guide burst suddenly into song.
Saint Nicholas, God is truth.
And a song written 800 years ago by a hermit monk in Old English.
At the bar
Guy Hayward, a classical singer, is leading a group of latter-day pilgrims out of the church and along a once well-trodden path.
We are on a section of the Old Way to Canterbury.
For centuries, he says, Christians from all over Europe walked this route along the south coast of England, up to Canterbury and the shrine of one of Christendom's most famous martyred saints.
St. Thomas a Becket was the second most dedicated saint all over Europe. There are lots of European churches dedicated to St. Thomas.
The saint with most churches bearing his name is St. James. The revival of the pilgrimage to his shrine in Santiago de Compostela has been big enough to regenerate the rural economy of northern Spain. It attracts a third of a million participants a year. Still early days for this rather more modest British route. There are just over a dozen walkers here today who've paid $50 each to take part. They're full of zeal, though. One of them is Jackie Norton, an entrepreneur.
And I love it because you go, you walk along, and then you get to a church, and then we chant, you know, and it's marvellously mad, but very freeing. It's just a lovely day out, isn't it?
Guy Hayward's pilgrimage is not exclusively religious. Along the route, at the top of a hill overlooking the sea, we find a secular shrine.
We're just approaching Paul McCartney's recording studio, which is in the form of a windmill.
You're lowering your voice, Guy. Not out of reverence.
He is a kind of musical deity, though, isn't he? So, you know, on one level, this is a holy place.
And so, before moving on, the pilgrims pay homage.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me.
BYOB, or bring your own beliefs, is the first rule of this pilgrimage. People of all faiths and none are welcome. It's all a curious mixture of Christian worship, nature walk and New Age healing. There's tree-hugging, berry-picking, and history lessons, for example, as we pass the ruins of a Tudor castle.
Henry VIII built this to protect against the potential French and Spanish invasion.
Guy strays occasionally from the path of strict historical accuracy, much to the pilgrims' hilarity. Everyone seems to be having fun. Unlike the medieval pilgrimage, this is, in no sense, a penance. We wander on across glorious undulating English countryside, past grazing sheep and through marshland with a balmy breeze whispering in the reeds. Pilgrim Theo Clark, the boss of a London-based charity, found it very refreshing.
It's kind of a way to see the countryside, get out of London, get a kind of touch of our history and our heritage, to meet some new people.
The pilgrimage ends as it began at a church. This one is St. Mary's in the medieval hilltop town of Rye.
Sainte Maria.
Guy sings a farewell song, another 800-year-old composition. He doesn't expect this pilgrimage will rival the economic impact of the one to Santiago, but he hopes he can at least spread the word and leave his pilgrims a footsore maybe, but happy.
With their in self God.
At Rye, in the county of East Sussex, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, about which, I mean, honestly, I don't know. And also, let's acknowledge this is a straight-up publicity play, shall we? KFC, Kentucky Fried Chicken, is effectively trying to buy your baby's naming rights. The company announced a sweepstakes today, $11,000 for the first kid born on September 9th, the birthday of KFC's founder, and And here's the gotcha named after him. That name, of course, is Colonel Sanders, first name Harland. So not only would your kid be named Harland, but you'd only get $11,000 for it. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 60 today, 0.2%. NASDAQ boosted 79 points, 0.9%. S&P 500, 16 points higher, about 0.5% there. Sarah Bergier, Jake Gorski, Drew Josted, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.